Lecture 19, Exchange Rate Policy.
The economics of exchange rates is a genuinely difficult topic, one of the hardest topics for people coming to economics for the first time. A fellow named Kenneth Casa, a modern economist, wrote a couple of years ago, "If you asked a random sample of economists to name the three most difficult questions confronting mankind, the answers would probably be question one, what is the meaning of life? Question two, what is the relationship between quantum mechanics and general relativity? And three, what's going on in the foreign exchange market?" Questions would not necessarily be in that order. Foreign exchange markets are genuinely difficult to think about. And I think one of the beginning sources of difficulty comes from unfortunate terminology around the idea of exchange rates. When the United States dollar buys more of something, when it buys more of other currencies, we say that the dollar has appreciated, or in the common language, we say the dollar has become stronger. On the other hand, if the U.S. dollar buys less of foreign currencies, we say the dollar has depreciated, or we say it is weaker. Now, here's the difficulty. Everyone knows, don't they? Everyone knows that being strong is better than being weak. Everyone knows that something being strong, like your currency, is a goal to be fought for, and being weak is something that you should fight against. But actually, that strong and weak terminology is just totally deceptive. The exchange rate, the rate at which one currency like the US dollar trades for other currencies, is just a price. It's just a price like any other price. And just like any other price, whether it's higher or lower, and whether that's a good or a bad thing, depends on what side of the market you're on. Imagine someone were to say to you, the price of oil is strong, meaning the price of oil is now higher than it was before. Well, is that good or bad? If you're an oil company and you're selling oil, presumably it's good. If you're a consumer and you're buying oil or buying gasoline, presumably it's not so good. So the question of whether strong or weak prices are good or bad for the economy are really just questions about, are you a buyer or a seller in the market? Sellers tend to like the strong prices, and buyers tend to be not so enthusiastic about them. Let's think about just a few examples of present-day exchange rates. Exchange rates are printed in any major newspaper just about every day, so these are just meant to be illustrative and give you a sense of some of the exchange rates that are out there. In the mid-part of 1998, a U.S. dollar would buy about $1.40 in Canadian dollars. It would buy about 5.7 French francs. It would buy about 1.8 German marks, 129 Japanese yen, 60% of a British pound, or about 75 Italian lira. And of course, you could convert any of those. That's what one U.S. dollar would buy. You could convert back and say one German mark would buy so much in dollars, or one yen would be worth so much in dollars. As far as trends in the foreign exchange market go, let me go back to about 1973. Before that point, from the end of World War II up until about 1973, exchange rates were largely controlled throughout the world economy. They were controlled by the Bretton Woods Agreement that you may have heard of. And so exchange rates were pretty much preset and predetermined throughout the world economy. However, in 1973 and around then, we started letting the exchange rate of the dollar move. It could get stronger, it could get weaker, and we were going to let the forces of supply and demand determine what the value of the dollar would be, not a preset government treaty. What happened to the dollar since then? Well, if you look at the dollar in the 1970s, a typical way of thinking about the dollar is rather than choosing to look at just the dollar versus one currency, like the Italian lira or the British pound, what you do is you take the overall average of all the currencies. Currencies where the U.S. does a lot of trade with that economy, like Canada or Mexico, get a relatively heavy weight. Currencies where the U.S. might not do so much trade with the economy, say Switzerland, a relatively small economy, their currency would have a much smaller weight. So we take an average of all the different currencies, weighted according to how much trade the U.S. does with them. And that overall weighting will tell us something about whether the dollar is stronger or weaker. So, we look at the 1970s. What we tend to see is the dollar, it's getting a little bit weaker. That is, it's buying a little bit less of foreign currencies, but it's not an enormous change. Then, kicking in right around 1980, 81 through 84, there's a sharp and rapid rise in the value of the dollar. The dollar becomes about 30% stronger. That is, a dollar buys about 30% more than it did before. Then, by about 1986, from 84 to 86, the dollar suddenly drops again, almost back to the level it was in the late 1970s. By the early 1990s, the dollar has declined somewhat further, and in fact, it's somewhat lower, somewhat weaker, if you want to put it that way, than it was back in 1973. But even this degree of volatility, where the dollar goes up 30% in a couple of years and then back down in the next 3 years, really understates how much volatility happens in foreign exchange markets. If you had a graph that showed what's the value of the dollar day by day, what you would see is that graph really jumps up and down a lot. Foreign exchange movements are rapid and volatile, and they leap around. And when we think about foreign exchange markets, we're going to need to think about that volatility and where it comes from, and why we don't sort of have more smoothness in the market for foreign exchange rates than we actually have. Let's think for a moment, though, before getting into those mechanics of how the market works, about who benefits from stronger exchange rates or weaker exchange rates. In particular, it's useful to think about this, I think, in the context of the 1980s. As the U.S. dollar became much stronger in the 1980s, from about 81 to 84, who benefited from that? Or in general, who benefits any time from a strong currency? Well, in a literal sense, the strength of a dollar reflects what people can buy with it. So, people who are buying with the dollar are going to feel better off as the dollar gets stronger. Try and illustrate what I mean by that. Let's give some examples and then think about whether these groups would be better or worse off with a strong dollar. For example, if you're a U.S. tourist traveling abroad, you're carrying a lot of dollars with you, maybe in the form of traveler's checks. You're converting them to foreign currencies as you go. How do you feel about it if during the course of your trip, the dollar gets stronger? Well, if you've traveled abroad, this isn't a hard question. As you travel along, the dollar gets stronger. That means when you trade your dollars for other currencies, it buys more of those local currencies. And so you're able to enjoy a fancier meal or a nicer hotel, perhaps, than you would have been expecting. A tourist traveling abroad, a U.S. tourist traveling abroad, is going to be happy with a stronger dollar. How about an importer into the U.S.? How does an importer into the U.S. feel as the dollar gets stronger and stronger? Well, if you were a Japanese company and you were selling in the United States, so the U.S. consumer is buying the imported product, remember that that Japanese company is going to want to take the dollars that it earns and trade back into yen so it can pay its suppliers and its investors and so on back home. If the dollar gets stronger and stronger, then the dollars that are being earned in the United States are worth more and more. And when that company turns around and trades them back into its home currency, it'll have higher profits than it expected. Exactly the reverse would be true if you're talking about an exporter from the United States. If you have an exporter with a strong dollar, then that exporter from the U.S. is earning foreign currencies. If the U.S. dollar is becoming stronger and stronger, then those foreign currencies are getting weaker and weaker. So when you earn those other currencies, German marks, Italian lira, French francs, and then you trade them back into dollars, you get fewer dollars than you were expecting. That's what a strong dollar does to you. And so exporters in the U.S. would be unhappy with a strong dollar. And finally, it's useful to think about foreign investors in the United States. If you were investing money in the United States from abroad, do you like a strong dollar or not? Well, presumably, you do like a strong dollar. And the reason is that when you've invested in the United States, you're getting paid your return in U.S. dollars, but then you're going to take those dollars and trade them in and go back to your home country. And when you trade it and go back to your home country, the dollars will bring in more than you had expected because the dollar got stronger. So, let's sort of sum this up a little bit. As dollar gets stronger and stronger, imports go up and up. Exports go down and down. We expect the trade deficit to get bigger as a result. However, as the trade deficit gets bigger and bigger, we also expect more people to find investing in the country attractive. And that makes perfect sense if you think back to Lecture 14, because after all, as the trade deficit gets bigger and bigger, that means more and more foreign investment flowing into the country. So all these patterns work together. More imports, fewer exports, more capital inflow coming into the country. To try and be clear on these different trends, it's often useful to just flip all this upside down and just reverse all the logic, walk through that as well, and get comfortable with what stronger and weaker dollars mean. Let's say, for example, that now we're talking instead of a stronger dollar about a weaker dollar, a dollar which buys less in terms of foreign currency. If you're a U.S. tourist traveling abroad, dollars in your pockets in terms of traveler's checks or something like that, and you want and you're worried about what happens as the dollar gets weaker, how do you feel about that? Well, presumably, now a weaker dollar makes you less happy. Makes you less happy because every time you take dollars out of your pocket and change them into the foreign currency, what you find is that you get less of that foreign currency than you were expecting. The dollar is weaker, it buys less of that foreign currency than you would have thought. So now you have to cut back on your vacation plans a little bit. What about if we're talking about an importer into the United States? If you were a Japanese firm, you were selling into the United States, you're earning U.S. dollars, the dollar gets weaker, how do you feel? Well, now those dollars you're earning are worth less and less. And when you think about transferring those dollars back into yen to pay your workers and your suppliers back home, you find that the profits you earned in the United States are less than you expected because of the weak dollar. What about a U.S. exporter selling abroad? Well, if the dollar is getting weaker and weaker, then one way to think about it is that the costs of that producer in the United States, which the costs, remember, are paid in dollars, would be getting less and less. Whereas the foreign currencies that they own, if the dollar is getting weaker and weaker, the foreign currencies must be getting stronger and stronger. So the foreign currency that you're earning abroad as an exporter makes you feel better and better. It's worth more and more with a weak dollar. And finally, if we think about foreign investors in the United States, we think about foreign investors who come and put money into the United States, what we would find is that they're unhappy about a weak dollar. Because they've invested in the United States, they're earning returns in U.S. dollars, but when they get around to taking those dollars and changing them back into their home currency, they're going to get less of their home currency than they expected with a weak dollar. So, let's sum up the effects of a weak dollar here. A weak dollar is going to mean that your imports are going down, your exports are going up. As your imports go down, your exports go up. You would expect your trade deficit to shrink, or perhaps you have a trade surplus. However, you would also expect to be not a very attractive place to invest. So your borrowing from abroad is going to go down and down, or if you're running a trade surplus, actually on net, you would be investing abroad, as we explained back in Lecture 14. So, these sorts of patterns are exactly what happened in the U.S. economy during the 1980s. We get a strong dollar, imports go up, the trade deficit goes up, there's lots of money flowing in from abroad, then the exchange rate goes down, and all those factors simply replace themselves. This shouldn't come really as a big shock if you think about it in this way. If you're a consumer and you're buying imported products using dollars, then a strong dollar means the buying power of your money is worth more. Effectively, the dollar is you shopping on world markets, if you want to think about it that way. So you can buy more foreign products. So you benefit from the strong dollar, you suffer from a weak one as a consumer. But if you're a business operating in the United States and you're trying to sell your products abroad, then you have a situation where your costs are in dollars, but the revenue you get is in other currencies. In that situation, a strong dollar means your costs are higher and higher, and a weak dollar means your costs are, relatively speaking, lower and lower. So if you're a business person, you'd like to have lower costs and higher profits abroad. Why do we care about the exchange rate? I mean, after all, if the exchange rate is just a price, and it is just a price, it's the price of one currency in terms of other currencies, why do we spend time worrying about it? Well, if you're a very small economy and you're doing lots and lots and lots of foreign trade, the exchange rate could be the single most important price in that entire economy. After all, if exports and imports were 60, 70, 80% of your gross domestic product, then your exchange rate determines the price of 60 or 80% of everything your economy is doing. In the U.S., however, we're not quite that dependent on trade. In the U.S., we're talking about exports and imports that are maybe, 10 or 12% of the U.S. economy. So in the U.S., it's still a tremendously important price. It's a price that affects 10 or 12% of the economy that's foreign trade. But it's perhaps less important than for a small country like Belgium or some small country in Latin America. One reason we presumably care about the exchange rate is simply that the exchange rate determines the long-run climate for business investment in one way or another. Think for a moment about what the U.S. economy would be like if we had a different currency for every single state in the United States. So there are 50 different currencies. And every time you moved between states, you had to swap money. And of course, every time you swap money, you probably have to pay about 0.5% or 1% to the bank for swapping the currency. In fact, if you look at Latin America or Europe, that scenario is sort of what's going on. There are all these countries, they all have different currencies, and every time you try and move between them, you have to swap currency. If you're a business person and you're thinking about making plans that might involve making something in one country and selling in another country, you have to take that into account. There's not only the normal risk from investment, the normal risk of things going wrong, the normal risk of not making money, but now there's a risk that even if all the business part of things goes just as you expect, perhaps the exchange rate moves in a direction you weren't expecting. And as a result, there's an extra level of risk that will discourage you from making plans that stretch back and forth across national borders. If we're thinking about why, for example, the U.S. economy is so well integrated, that is to say, different states sell in other states, they transport back and forth other states, there's no big issue in that happening. And why we don't see that in Europe or in Latin America, clearly one of the reasons is that there are all those different currencies in those other places. And part of the drive for, say, a single currency in Europe, the euro, would be to have a stable long-run climate where everyone could make plans, they would know the currency wasn't going to be jumping around. This is especially true if you think back to the 1980s. When you think of the U.S. currency in a period of a couple years suddenly shooting up and then suddenly shooting down again, that sort of 30% increase, 30% decrease just wreaks havoc on the kinds of plans you would like to make as a business person. Much smaller changes than that, even 5 or 10%, could wreak havoc on the plans that you're trying to make. So one reason for caring about the exchange rate is kind of like the reason for caring about inflation. We care about inflation partly because we don't want to mess up the price signals in the economy. And we care about the exchange rate partly because we don't want to mess up the price signals in the world economy either. We'd like people to be able to make plans and make long-term plans to operate back and forth across borders without worrying that the exchange rate's going to wipe them out. There's a second reason a lot of people talk about worrying about the exchange rate. And this reason, however, I think is a false one, but it's so widespread that it's really worth talking about a little bit. I think of this theory as we care about the exchange rate because we think we can depreciate our way to happiness. Now, how exactly would this work in practice? Let's say that we depreciate our currency. We weaken it. We make it worth less than it would be before. What would we expect to happen in our economy? Well, remember that as the currency gets weaker, then the costs of our businesses effectively are going down and down. And they're going to find it easier to export and sell abroad. However, imports coming into the country are going to bring less money for those people trying to ship into the country. And as a result, we would expect that as the currency goes down and down, exports go up, imports go down. Well, first of all, this sounds great. After all, we fixed the trade deficit. Our exports go up, our imports go down. We also would say we have more aggregate demand in the economy. There's more buying power out there because our exports are selling better. So we get more aggregate demand, we can maybe wipe out our cyclical unemployment. We can raise our gross domestic product. We can generally depreciate our way to happiness. Now, there must be something wrong with this line of thought. There must be something wrong with it. Just recently, in the last year or so, we found that a number of currencies all over East Asia collapsed. The currencies were worth half or a third or 20% of their earlier value. Well, heck, if you can depreciate your way to happiness, those folks where their currencies just went down to half or a third or 20% of their previous value, they should feel rich. They should feel great because all of a sudden their currency's not worth very much. And even phrasing the point in that way begins to get at the problem with this line of thought. Remember that as you depreciate your currency, what you're really saying is the currency buys less and less and less and less. So saying that we could depreciate things and make our gross domestic product higher is kind of like saying we'll make our currency worth less and less and less and less, and then our economy will look bigger. Well, that's sort of true, but it's also sort of a weird way to look at the world. In general, when you start depreciating your currency, if you depreciate it all the way down so your currency was worth almost nothing, in this theory, you would be really rich. What's really happening when you depreciate your currency is important to remember, is that what you're doing is this advantage, this extra exports you get, come out of making your costs lower. When you depreciate your currency, what you're really saying to workers in your economy is, when we pay you U.S. dollars, we're going to depreciate those dollars. So effectively what we're doing is we're making the wages you get paid worth less and less and less and less. And sure, as the wages are worth less and less, you'll be able to sell more in the world economy, but any policy that depends on depressing wages is probably not a long-term route to economic health. Moreover, this sort of goal that, wow, we could wipe out the trade deficit is one of those goals where I hope when someone says that, you really think twice about it. Remember, you wipe out the trade deficit, you also wipe out the flow of investment capital coming into the country. Because after all, the trade deficit is the same as the flow of investment capital coming into the country. So maybe before we talk about wiping out that trade deficit, we should think about where our investment capital is going to come from and how we're going to keep getting that in the future. As a policy tool, trying to depreciate your way into prosperity is just not all that sensible. But it is often proposed, particularly by exporters, who feel like, well, if the currency were just a little bit cheaper, we'd be able to sell more abroad. It's not uncommon when an economy is in recession to hear people say, well, let's just get the currency down a little bit. If we just get it down a little bit, then we'll be more competitive. And that's usually the way it's phrased. We'll be more competitive. What they mean, of course, is the wages paid to workers will be less, and therefore will be more competitive. But you'll rarely hear people say it that way. To see the problem here a little bit more deeply, what we really need to look at is how the exchange rate is determined. And thus, if we're thinking about a higher or a lower exchange rate, how public policy might be used to affect the exchange rate. Let's consider a range of possible exchange rate policies. Let's start off first with just perfect freedom for exchange rates. In other words, we're just going to let supply and demand work. Whatever supply and demand tell us the exchange rate is, that's what it's going to be. But when we think about exchange rates, it's important to think a little bit about what is supply and demand here? Because it's not as obvious as in some of the other markets we talked about where there were fairly clear buyers and fairly clear sellers. And I'll phrase this example just for the sake of concreteness in terms of the U.S. dollar and the German mark. And so let's talk about those supply and demand for dollars and marks, as if these were the sort of the only two countries in the world. First of all, where is supply coming from if we're talking about the dollar in terms of the German mark? Who's supplying currency into the foreign exchange market? Well, presumably, anyone is supplying currency if they're coming into the market with dollars and they're trying to switch those dollars into German marks. Who would examples be of people who are trying to switch dollars into marks? Well, for example, one set of suppliers would be tourists who are going over to Germany. They are supplying their dollars, and then they're asking for marks in exchange. Another example, this is a little more subtle, would be German exporters to the United States. Remember, those German exporters come over to the United States, they sell in the United States, and they earn U.S. dollars. But now they want to take those dollars back to Germany. And when they take them back to Germany, they're going to change them into marks so they can pay their suppliers and their workers and their investors and so on. So those folks have dollars that they are supplying into the foreign exchange market so they can get the marks they want. Another supplier of dollars would be those who want to invest in Germany. If I wanted to buy German stocks or bonds and I've got dollars, I've got to first take my dollars and change them into marks. So I would take my dollars, swap them into marks, and then use those marks to invest in Germany. So when we think about supply side of this market, who's supplying dollars to the foreign exchange market. Some examples would be tourists, German exporters, and those who are trying to invest in German stuff. What about demand for dollars? Who would be on the demand side? Who would be on the side of demanding dollars, taking marks, and wanting to switch them into dollars? Well, we can just sort of reverse some of the categories we talked about a moment ago. German tourists in the United States, for example, are obviously in a position where they're bringing marks along. They want to switch those marks into dollars, and so they're demanding dollars and offering their marks. U.S. exporters to Germany go over to Germany. They earn German marks, but in order to pay their suppliers and their workers and their investors, they need to come back and switch those marks into dollars. So they would take the marks they earned, they would supply the marks, but they would be demanding U.S. dollars. And finally, demand for dollars would come from anyone who wanted to invest in U.S. assets. If you wanted to invest in the U.S. stock market, you wanted to buy land in the United States, you wanted to buy anything in the U.S., presumably what you've got to do is bring your marks or your other foreign currency and demand dollars in order to get the currency that you can use to buy stocks on the U.S. stock exchange. So we can think of these forces of supply and demand. Those people who are supplying dollars into the market, trying to trade away into other things, and those who are demanding dollars from the market because they want to use those dollars in some way. And when we think about exchange rate policies, all we're really thinking about is those forces of supply and demand coming together. And however they come together, whatever price they determine, whatever exchange rate they determine, it sort of balances things out, balances the quantity of dollars supplied with the quantity demanded, that'll be the exchange rate price. Now, what would we expect to happen? What would be the things that would sort of determine this price over time? What would make the dollar get stronger or weaker? Well, one obvious example would be interest rates and interest rate differences between the two countries. Let's imagine for a moment that U.S. interest rates go up. If U.S. interest rates go up, what happens to, and say, German interest rates stay the same, then what happens to supply and demand for dollars? Well, if U.S. interest rates are higher, then all of a sudden investing in the United States is going to look more attractive. That's going to mean more people are demanding dollars because they're going to want to invest more. And as those people demand those dollars and they try and invest more, demand goes up and up, and we would expect that the dollar gets stronger as a result. The price of the dollar gets higher just because demand for the dollar has gone up. Think about that same thing in the reverse way. If the dollar is a higher interest rate and mark interest rates are pretty low, then not so many people are going to want to be supplying dollars anymore. They won't want to give up their dollars for something else. Instead, they'll want to hang on to their dollars so they can invest them in these high interest rates. And again, less supply will tend to drive up the price. Driving up the price means a stronger dollar. So interest rates are a powerful tool that can be used to shape what the exchange rate is going to be. Remember that the exchange rate in an economy is basically under control of monetary policy. The monetary authorities, by using expansionary and contractionary policies, can make the interest rate go up or down. And by making the interest rate go up or down, they can also make the exchange rate go up or down, should they want to do so. So we now have a link from the monetary policies we talked about over to interest rates, and on there over to the exchange rate. If we want to adjust the exchange rate, we have a tool for doing so. In the long run, though, there's some belief that it's going to be difficult just to set the exchange rate wherever we want. There's a theory which is sometimes called PPP, or purchasing power parity. And purchasing power parity basically holds that at the end of the day, over the long run, and again that long run is sort of a fudge word there, but over the long run, that the value of a currency should be roughly equal to what it can buy. If it was possible in the United States to buy a whole lot of steel, a whole lot of cars, a whole lot of wheat, a whole lot of internationally traded things, and buy them really cheaply in the United States, and then ship those things over to Germany and sell them and make a whole lot of money, then we would say that the exchange rate had to be out of whack in purchasing power parity terms. Roughly speaking, purchasing power parity says that if you take German marks and you buy a whole lot of stuff in Germany, you should get about the same amount of stuff as you get if you change those marks into dollars and come buy a whole lot of stuff in the United States. Otherwise, there would be opportunities for profit. People could buy cheaply in one country and go ship over to the other country. So in the long run, we would expect that purchasing power parity will really make a difference as to what a currency is going to be worth. We would also expect that inflation will make a big difference. In a way, this just ties back to the purchasing power parity idea. But if there's a lot of inflation in one country, say the United States is having high inflation and Germany is having low inflation, inflation just tells you, remember, that the value of a currency is getting to be less and less and less and less. So if inflation is shrinking the value of the U.S. dollar more than inflation in Germany is shrinking the value of the mark, we would expect the dollar to depreciate against the mark, to be worth less and less and less over time. So when you look at the foreign exchange market, you need to think about all these different factors happening at once. You need to think about the factors of the interest rate, a policy tool that can be moved around. You need to think about what can actually be bought with the currency and the purchasing power parity theory. You need to think about inflation and whether it's going up or down. But with all those thoughts, now we get to the single most complicated factor, and the factor which really makes exchange rates very difficult to deal with. And that is that you can speculate on exchange rates. A lot of the time, when you're buying or selling dollars or any other currency, what you're really doing, or what someone is really doing, is betting on whether the dollar will be stronger and weaker, just the same way if you buy stock, you're betting that the price of stock will go up. So lots of people might buy dollars today because they expect dollars to become stronger in the future. Or they might ditch lots of dollars today, and they might ditch the dollars because they expect the dollar to be weaker in the future, and they don't want to be on the losing end of that deal. What makes speculation particularly difficult to think about is that it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Imagine, for example, that I think, just think, that inflation over there in Germany is going to be really high. I expect it to happen. It hasn't happened yet, but I expect it to happen. Well, in that case, what do? I start saying, well, if inflation's coming, then I expect the German mark will be worth less and less. And because it's worth less and less, I'm going to sell it now. I'm going to get rid of it. But by selling it, by getting rid of it, I reduce the demand for those marks, and by reducing the demand for them, or increasing the supply of them, as I get rid of the marks that I've got, I'm actually going to drive down the price of the mark. And so my expectation that the mark will depreciate turns into a reality, that the mark really does depreciate. Markets like this are very difficult to figure out, and we're now kind of at the heart of the problem as to why we might expect exchange rates to jump up and down and up and down, why we might expect them to be so volatile. They're so volatile because there are a lot of speculators involved. And when there are a lot of speculators involved, the speculators are chasing trends. They're trying to predict the trend, and then the trend is coming true for a short time, then they all run in the other direction, and it comes true for a short time, and they run back and forth and back and forth. Over the long term, factors like interest rates or the purchasing power parity theory are going to determine where the exchange rate ends up. But in the short run, meaning over 3 months, 6 months, even over a couple of years sometimes, you're going to see the dollar or any currency leaping up and down as people trade an enormous amount in the exchange rate markets. In fact, it's now estimated, I think, that exchange rate markets are trading, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars a day. And there's no government out there which can go out and just sort of stop this enormous market which is happening, full of speculators, all sitting at their computer terminals, all, you know, hitting the buttons very quickly, almost like a video game, chasing the trends up and down. So given this difficulty that the currency has factors of supply and demand, that it's bouncing up and down, the question would be, okay, well, what can we do about this? Can we somehow reduce this volatility? After all, we want a stable currency because it helps long-term planning. And so, is there some way that we could go about getting a more stable currency and not have these leaps and ups and downs and jumps and starts? Well, we certainly can set the currency rate if we want to. It is possible to do so. And we've already identified the tool that would let us do it. Imagine that we have a certain currency level that we want, a certain exchange rate that we want to have for our economy. And we settle on that, perhaps we vote on it, the president decides on it, whatever. So we decide on some particular level for the currency. Well, if the exchange rate seems to be pushed below that level, if it seems to be depreciating, we simply go to the central bank and we say, hey, we need you to raise interest rates. Because that will increase demand for our currency, and it'll push the currency back to where it was before. If the currency seems to be getting stronger and stronger, we go to the central bank. We say, well, we need you to cut interest rates. That'll make our currency less attractive to investors, and as it becomes less attractive, the exchange rate will come down and it'll go back to where it was before. So we could use monetary policy to adjust the exchange rate, to make it higher or lower as we desired. We could also try and peg the currency in other ways. For example, some countries have tried to simply stop the flow of foreign exchange trading. They've said, we're just not going to allow trading in our currency. We're not going to allow investment to flow in and out of our country. We're going to put limits on the amount of currency that can be bought and sold. We're going to put limits on foreign investment. I think a charitable way of describing most of those efforts is that they failed. And they failed because it's very hard, given a big world, given that 24-hour trading is happening all over the planet in all sorts of different countries, it's very hard to say no one can trade our currency. That's just tremendously difficult to do. The difficult thing about setting a currency is that if you set a currency, you have to make sure that it's a currency which is sustainable over a long period of time, or an exchange rate which is sustainable over a long period of time. And presumably what that means is you have to choose the long-term purchasing power parity exchange rate. You have to choose the exchange rate where it will stay there comfortably on its own. If you choose an exchange rate which is unrealistically high, then everyone is always going to be trying to dump your currency. If you choose an exchange rate which is unrealistically low, people are going to be buying it and buying it. And so you need to set your currency, to peg your currency, in a way which will hold up over the long run. Now, that's just very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do because these speculative markets that are out there are so huge and they have such powerful effect on exchange rate markets. And in fact, if we look at the 1990s, you see a number of collapses of currencies which really have to do with speculative attacks on various currencies. One example in the early 1990s happened in Britain and Europe. When they had a whole lot of their currencies, they thought at nice preset values, all the exchange rates were set, and the system was essentially attacked. What happened in Britain was, in the early 1990s, was that inflation seemed to be heading up. People thought, oh boy, inflation's heading up. That means the British pound is likely to depreciate, so they massively sold the pound. They sold it and sold it and sold it. And as they did that, as they got rid of pounds, they actually forced the pound to depreciate. They forced it to be worth less and less. Now, the Bank of England tried to defend the pound. They tried to say, hey, we'll give you high interest rates. Don't sell. Please, don't sell. But the Bank of England did that for a little bit, and then they said, the heck with it. There's hundreds of billions of dollars floating around out there. We can't change the mind of hundreds of billions of dollars. We need to just sort of let the currency go to where it's going to go. A similar thing happened in Mexico at the end of 1994. In Mexico, there was a situation where speculators looked at the Mexican economy. They said, we don't think this currency is going to stay where it is. We don't think it can hold up. We think there's some inflation coming. We think there's some high government spending coming. We don't think this is a stable, steady economy. And when they said that, they fled the Mexican currency. They dumped it. They sold it. They got rid of it every way they could. And as they did that, even though nothing terrible had happened in Mexico yet, the act of expecting that something terrible was going to happen forced the price of the Mexican peso down and down and down and down, forcing a bailout by the U.S. government and the International Monetary Fund. More recently, exactly the same scenario has played itself out in East Asia. A number of those economies have been enormous international success stories. They've been booming and booming and booming for several decades now. And of course, it's been well known for decades that, yeah, these economies were growing very well, but they had some problems. They had some problems of corruption. They had some problems of other issues. But they seemed to be doing so well that they were attracting extraordinary amounts of investment. However, some people began to notice sort of a frightening thing. The frightening thing was that in East Asia, a number of the governments were indeed pegging their currencies. That is, the central banks in Indonesia, Malaysia, South Korea were adjusting their interest rates up and down in such a way as to try and make sure that their currency would exchange for U.S. dollars at exactly the same rate. Nothing wrong with that as far as it goes. But then something else happened. And that something else was that interest rates were quite high in the United States compared to these other countries. So think about this scenario for a moment. What do you do in this kind of a setting? If you're a business in, say, Indonesia, what you do is you take as many of the Indonesian currency as you can, you go over to the United States, you convert it into dollars, you get the high interest rate in dollars, and then you convert back to the currency in Indonesia. And that guarantees you high profits. Sounds so simple, doesn't it? The problem is that the more and more people who are doing that, the more and more you're in a situation where if the exchange rate moves, if all of a sudden your exchange rate isn't worth what you thought, this business of going overseas, collecting the benefits, and coming back is not going to work nearly so well. The economies of those countries stumbled a little bit. And I say, there have been signs they might stumble for a while. But when they stumbled just a little bit, hundreds of billions of dollars in capital said, whoa, this is something that might create a real problem. We need to flee these currencies. And so, just as happened in Britain, just as happened in Mexico, currency fled out of those countries. As they left those countries, the currencies came down and down by half, by two-thirds. And as the currencies came down, those economies found that they just couldn't make money the way they had been making it before. There were all kinds of bankruptcies. There were all kinds of difficulties. Think about it for a moment. If you are in a situation where you have all of your assets in a country with a very, where the currency going down and down, effectively that means that the value of your company or the value of your wages have gone down and down and down by that much too. As I said before, if depreciation were as a way to riches, boy, those countries in East Asia would be awfully rich right now. But what we're really seeing is just another speculative cycle, just like we've seen throughout the rest of the global economy in the 1990s. Is there a way to tame these speculative cycles? Is there a way to change things so that we could avoid these big swings? It's really hard to see how. There are, of course, as you might imagine, a number of economists that have proposals for doing these things, and it's the job, officially, of the International Monetary Fund to act almost like a central bank for the world. That when there are these problems of currency runs and people racing out of one currency and racing into another, the job of the International Monetary Fund is to try and smooth that out to some extent, to try and not let things go completely crazy, to be, as we talked about with the Fed, something of a lender of last resort in those cases. But ultimately, it's like if there's an enormous storm pouring over your head. You do what you can to keep your basement from filling up with water, but you're not going to stop the storm. When hundreds of billions of dollars in currency investment starts leaving a country, the IMF or anyone else, you can only sort of try and say, oh, maybe don't do this. We'll slow it down a little bit, but you're not going to stop the flood. The real difficult part for a lot of countries when it comes to thinking about exchange rates and currency is that there's a trade-off you have to face. And the trade-off is a trade-off between domestic economic policy and foreign exchange rates. This was one of the questions raised in that quotation from Bennett McCallum in Lecture 16. Think about this problem. Imagine that you've said, as a small economy, well, okay, we're a small economy, trade is very important to us, the exchange rate influences a lot of our economy, and because it influences a lot of our economy, we're going to set it at a certain rate, and we're going to try and keep it at that rate. Fair enough, that's all reasonable enough. But once you've said, we're going to use our interest rates to control the exchange rate, then you can't use the interest rates for other things. Perhaps you have to raise your interest rates in order to keep your currency at the level you want it to be at. But if you're raising your interest rates to keep the currency at a certain level, then you can't be simultaneously lowering your interest rates in order to stimulate the economy or cut unemployment. Conversely, if you're thinking, well, we need to reduce our interest rates in order to get the currency down, well, then you can't be raising them in order to fight inflation at the same time. Interest rates and monetary policy are one tool. And because it's only one tool, it's like a dart. You can only throw at one target. I mean, I can throw it at the unemployment target. I can throw it at the inflation target. I can throw it at the exchange rate target. But I can't simultaneously throw it at all three targets. I have to choose one of them. And so if I choose the exchange rate target, if I choose to use my monetary authority and the interest rates in order to affect the exchange rate, what I'm essentially saying is I no longer can use monetary policy or the interest rate for my domestic goals. Now, my interest rates and my monetary policy are simply going to react to the forces of supply and demand out there in the economy. That's a very difficult thing to do. An awful lot of governments have said at one time or another, well, we really want to keep our exchange rate at a certain level. And when they said it, I think they genuinely meant it. But then a few years later, they got into a situation where there was a collision between are we going to keep the exchange rate where we wanted, or are we going to fight unemployment, or are we going to fight inflation? And when they got to that point, a lot of governments found that the domestic concerns of unemployment and inflation, politically speaking, really had to come first. They had to be politically what the government focused on. What we can do to some extent is use government policy to make speculators pay a little bit. One of the ways of discouraging speculation, of course, is to let people know that you might speculate, but you might also be wrong. And so sometimes it's useful to try and drop the amount of speculation, reduce the amount of speculation in currency markets by making speculators lose a little bit of money. For example, if you say all the speculators think, oh boy, this is a situation where we're really going to get this currency. We think the currency is going to depreciate in value. Let's all sell it right now. Well, sometimes the central bank might want to come along and say, hey, we just raised the interest rates, and all you people who just sold the currency, hey, it's now stronger again, and you've just lost some money. Maybe you can't keep it stronger forever, but boy, if you can cause speculators to lose some money even in the short term, you'll have their attention, and they might not be so eager to dump your currency in the future. So you can try and lean against the wind a little bit, lean against the trends in the foreign exchange market. But I would say that ultimately, where most economists and most policymakers have really come out in the foreign exchange markets is that you can't shape this force. It's too big, it's too global, too much money is being traded. It's just not worth, for most countries, trying to fix the exchange rate and keep it in one place. Because there's just too much money, there's too many things going on. Instead, we should sort of keep the exchange rate relatively stable when we can, but just recognize that we're going to use monetary policy and fiscal policy for the other goals, and we're just going to let the exchange rate, like any price, go up and down according to how the market takes it.